Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. From May and April's severe weather and flooding to the polar vortex-induced record cold. Remember that back in January? This hour, we ask, what's up with the extreme weather we've been having? So far this year, the Plains and the Midwest have been seeing record-breaking weather, records for colds or snow, for flooding. And then last month in May, hundreds of reports of tornadoes across the country were added to the list. Today we look back at the extreme weather we've been having and explore the possible causes for the uptick, try to get a sense of where we're headed weather-wise. And we'd like to have you join us as well with your extreme weather questions, or maybe you've been caught in some extreme weather. You can tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio if you'd like. And this as an aside, yesterday, of course, the U.S. House of Representatives approved an over $19 billion disaster relief package. Finally, there's a whole story there. Politics, not our topic today. That package, including flood aid for Iowans. The president's likely to sign it into law this week. 58 House Republicans voted against that package on Monday, but it passed with the support of 354 House members, including all 4 of Iowa's members of the House of Representatives. But today, we're going to be focusing on the extreme weather. Leave politics for tomorrow, politics Wednesday. Joining us, first of all, Antonio Arenas is an assistant research engineer at the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. Antonio, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
I'd like to have you describe a little bit what I've been looking at this morning in the past few days. You've created an online timeline that illustrates significant weather events in recent history. The title of the first page is The Dice Are Loaded. Tell us about the timeline you created and what inspired it.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to say is that it wasn't just me. So my colleagues and I at the Iowa Flood Center created this timeline with the goal of summarizing extreme weather that we have seen over the last about 12 months, about an entire year. And we created a timeline that can be easily accessible online and that, like I said, summarizes extreme weather events with some interesting visuals for people to see and mostly do not remember how frequent extreme weather is becoming for Iowa and the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. And that's an important point I want to come back to. But first of all, for those listeners who are on Twitter, you can find it. We've just tweeted that out. Iowa Public Radio has, if you follow us. It's a really impressive timeline with animations, videos, maps, satellite images, brief descriptions of this extreme precipitation, the reservoirs, the flooded rivers, all kinds of things there. Let me come back to the point. We have this in our news, Antonio, every day, the floods. We're going to hear from our reporters here in just a moment, Katie Pikus and Kate Payne here. They have been doggedly covering the flood in the eastern and western parts of the state. We're well informed about it. But the impact that I had, and I assume you had and intended here, you and your colleagues, is different when you stack it all up in a timeline and can click through it very quickly. What did you intend here to have as a takeaway?
Yeah, so the main goal, like I said, is for people to remember how frequent extreme weather has been. So we tend to forget what happened, you know, 2 or 3 weeks prior when a new extreme weather event impacts communities nearby or perhaps ourselves. So what we wanted to do is to put everything together for people to be able to see all the things that have been going on as far as extreme weather going back to June 2018.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take some of the events that you bring out in this online timeline. Let's talk about the winter that we had. Certainly a remarkable winter, long and cold. Some facts you bring out there that have a tie to the flooding that we've experienced this spring, too. Why did you include the long, cold winter, and how does it fit into the context of the past 12 months of extreme weather?
Oh, the winter we just had played a very important role in the flooding. On both, on the Missouri River and the Mississippi River. Very cold temperatures create two potential phenomena that affect flooding. The first one is frozen ground. And as I tried to mention in the timeline, frozen ground behaves more like an impermeable surface. And any runoff or precipitation that we get, precipitation or snowmelt, has basically nowhere to go but becoming runoff. In addition to that, February, for the most part, was a very snowy month. And when you have cold temperatures with snowfall, all you have is a snowfall accumulation and accumulation. And what happened here, it was at around March the 12th, temperatures went up. Melting started happening across the state. And in addition to that, as most of your listeners remember, we had an extreme event called the bomb cyclone that added to the ongoing runoff. So winter processes, just to summarize, winter processes do play a role in flooding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, on the ground, one of the slides you look at I think this was sort of the genesis of the project. In fact, the reservoirs at the Sailorville Lake and at the mm-hmm. Coralville Lake. Talk about how they fit into this picture.
We realized by doing data analysis that extreme weather on the wet side of the spectrum began approximately at the end of the spring. And the month that we decided to begin our timeline was June 2018. June 2018 was a month with extremely above precipitation, above normal precipitation. And as a consequence of that, the Sailorville Reservoir, upstream from the city of Des Moines, came close to having uncontrolled releases. Then, later in October, basically the same happened to the Coralville Reservoir, upstream from Iowa City. So we had an example how in the same year, because of June extreme precipitation and because of the fall extreme precipitation, both reservoirs came close to having uncontrolled releases.
Uncontrolled releases, meaning that they can open up the outlet as far as they can, but it still can't deal with the water. The water just goes over the barrier, almost.
Exactly, almost. So in the Coralville Reservoir, we came within a foot of having those uncontrolled releases.
Right.
Just 1 foot.
I've seen a reservoir, the Coralville Reservoir, in fact, we're standing right next to that wall. It's quite an amazing thing I'm sure you have too, to stand next to one of these walls and realize how many tons of water uh-huh. are being held back by these reservoir dams.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so those are a couple things well illustrated in this timeline. Antonio Arenas, if you just joined us, assistant research engineer at the University of Iowa, the Iowa Flood Center, which is at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I want to have a couple of our reporters join us. Katie Pikus is with us, our Iowa Public Radio Western Iowa reporter. Hi, Katie.
Hey, Ben.
Kate Payne is with us as well, our Eastern Iowa reporter. So you are the two halves of our little comparison here. Hi, Kate Payne.
Hi.
And let's talk a little bit. Share some of the reporting, some of the highlights of the reporting tied to the extreme weather and flooding that we've had. Katie Pikus in Western Iowa, let's have you talk about, some of the most current reporting you've done that has had to do with the extreme weather. We still have parts of Western Iowa certainly trying to recover from the massive flooding, right?
Yeah, we do, and it's really been interesting to see their responses in Southwest Iowa, where some of the smaller communities had not even been let back into their homes yet because officials were so worried that this is going to continue and water continued to remain in place and the levees are breached, versus other communities kind of in Western Iowa near Sioux City that have gotten back and they're starting to rebuild.
Mm-hmm. In recent days, you've been checking in with Hornick in Southwest Iowa with some updates.
Yeah, and Hornick actually in Western Iowa near Woodbury County, where they were only evacuated for a few days in March. Actually, in Hornick right now, people are starting to get back, or they've gotten back and they're rebuilding. About 10 to 12 families are still not back in their homes, according to the mayor. And right now, the city is looking at how can we prevent this in the future. They're starting to talk about how they can prevent water from getting into town or how they can protect major infrastructure, but they're still kind of working on the plans, and they plan to talk about it at a future town hall meeting.
Mm-hmm. Katie Pikus, I wonder, in some of these communities so devastated by the flooding, and the duration of the flooding is really remarkable, how long the water stayed in the areas that were flooded. Are there towns that it's questionable whether residents will return, will rebuild? Will the community ever exist again as it did before the flooding?
Yeah, one of the biggest things I was hearing, especially when I visited Fremont County in southwest Iowa in the beginning of April, some officials did express concern that their counties would lose population because people simply can't get back home and rebuild. And I mean, right now we're seeing several communities that have been evacuated since mid-March, and we're getting into that period of having almost been 3 months for some of them. So they don't know at this point.
Mm-hmm. Katie Pikus in Western Iowa. Let's pivot over to Kate Payne, our Eastern Iowa reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Kate, you've been focusing in your reporting lately on the Davenport situation. Remind us what happened in Davenport, of course, along the Mississippi, our eastern border. That's why also this program is called River to River. The eastern border is the Mississippi, the western, the Missouri. Remind us what's happened in Davenport in recent weeks.
Yeah, so in Davenport a few weeks ago, they had an experience where their temporary flood barrier, called a HESCO barrier, these sort of sand bags protected by metal, their temporary flood wall broke in downtown. So this was sort of an unpredicted event where the river water that was being held back for days and days rushed into the downtown, into people's basements, as well as into the first floors of some buildings, cutting off access to some buildings entirely. Roads were closed down. Very disruptive for a small subset of businesses there in the downtown of Davenport.
Right, and it was really a situation, a somewhat panicked situation, where people had to grab what they could at the moment and leave. And if not, there were tens of people who were left there and had to be evacuated by other means, right?
Yes, so officials did have to evacuate some folks by boat out of a particular apartment building there in downtown. And folks, again, did tell me it was a matter of seconds of watching this water, a wall of water, just rush. People's cars were abandoned because they didn't have time to move them. It was really unpredictable for them.
And Davenport has long had the debate over a flood wall rather than these temporary barriers. Tell us the nature of this debate. What are the sides saying, have they said?
So Davenport, like many communities in the state, has seen a series of record-breaking floods since about 1965. And at each instance, Davenport as a community decided that they did not want to build a permanent flood wall in the way that other communities in the state have. For Davenport, they are very concerned about the cost, absolutely, which could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. But Davenport as a city also, you know, folks there say they really value their access to the riverfront. They don't want to sacrifice that by building a hardened wall that separates them from the river. And they're worried about worsening impacts elsewhere in the watershed. Mm-hmm. And so they have so far decided to not build a permanent wall and are making do with other approaches, putting in parkland, putting in these temporary barriers.
I wonder if the what the current situation is, and if the current situation, this latest breach of those temporary barriers, has changed any minds in that area.
Some folks that I have talked to, yes. For some of them, you know, I've heard from lifelong residents of Davenport who say, "I have wanted a wall my entire life. I've never been satisfied with this." Others, even business owners who are seeing some of the worst damage, tell me they don't want the flood wall. They don't believe it's the right choice for Davenport. So we'll see how that plays out in the months to come.
Okay, join our conversation if you have an extreme weather question, or you've experienced it yourself. You've been caught in extreme weather. 1-866-780-9100. Travis is joining us from Des Moines. Thanks for tuning in, Travis. You have a question or an experience to share?
More of a question. You guys actually had someone on yesterday talking about he commented that this year seems to be reminding him of the floods of 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we had like the floods of 2008 and 12. And I'm wondering, you know, are we going to be seeing this year or in upcoming years more floods similar to that of 1993?
Mm, interesting question. Now, Antonio Arenas, you looked specifically in this timeline at a 12-month period.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us any idea? What can you tell us about the context when we go back further, talking about the Great Flood of 93, for instance, that really expanded the Mississippi to an enormous width?
Yeah, so there have been some examples in the last 12 months for which levels recorded, I can think, for instance, of the Mississippi levels at Davenport on May the 2nd. According to the data that I saw, levels at the Mississippi River surpassed those measured in 1993. I wouldn't go as far as to say that all the conditions are given for the to have a repeat of the 1993. So that is something that I'm not comfortable saying. And actually, honestly speaking, it's a little bit outside of my area of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
But in some instances, that has happened. Levels, I guess, records have been broken.
Uh-huh. And Kate, following that in Davenport, you're well aware of that. So this was higher than 93?
Yeah, Antonio's right about this. So that, it was on May 2nd, it was recorded the highest flood stage on record. That's going back more than 150 years. We saw the highest flood on record there in Davenport and other communities in Burlington, where we're also seeing flooding. The flooding they saw at the same time was their fourth highest on record.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some variability there. But when I talk to other flood researchers, they're saying, you know, we are getting more rain. We are getting more floods. But there is some still questions remaining about, are those floods in greater intensity?
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question here, when we compare it, Travis there in Des Moines saying, compare it with 93, what's the difference when you have a flood level exceeding what it did in 93 in the Davenport along the Mississippi, and yet you don't have the widespread flooding? Is it the things that we've done in the meantime with flood mitigation, with reservoirs that have perhaps prevented the amount of devastation that we had in 93? Any thoughts there?
I mean, I can offer some thoughts. So I'd say that first, the nature of every major flood is different. So comparisons are very difficult to make. One thing that I've researched about in regards to the 1993 is that the flood of 1993 was really, really widespread, even more than what we are seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I've read extensively about that flood. As far as making a direct comparison, so like I said,
it's hard.
So I'm
just being very simple about this. I think about, well, my bathtub. If my bathtub goes up to a certain level and then flows out, it's a pretty simple picture. But flooding in a geographical space is much more complicated than a bathtub, to understate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go back to Katie Pikus in Western Iowa, our Western Iowa reporter there. Katie, tell us a little bit about the reporting you did about how, some of our federal elected officials, our U.S. senators, had a debate, let's say, with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers about how to possibly do a better job of managing the Missouri River Basin so that flooding does not happen in the future.
Right, yeah. So they held a Senate field hearing that Senator Ernst called in the middle of April. And I have not heard much since then, but there is a lot of concern right now on from a lot of the residents in Southwest Iowa on what are the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers going to do to fix breaches in the levee systems in Southwest Iowa, and what are they going to do to make sure that flooding does not happen again as we see more extreme precipitation, you know, mm-hmm. in more recent years and to come. So that's kind of one of the major questions that still lingers right now, is what are they going to do?
Mm-hmm. And the governors, not only, Governor Reynolds of Iowa, but also the governors of Nebraska and Missouri, want more input in managing the Missouri River. This has spurred some action there from our top executives in our states, right?
Yeah, they do. And the four governors continue to engage in conversations with the Corps of Engineers every once in a while, just so that they're hearing firsthand what's going on and what is the Corps doing and, you know, how they can better advise residents in their states.
Mm-hmm. And Antonio, let me go back to you quickly to talk a little bit more about these events that you outline on your timeline. Watersheds is something that you address in your timeline. Help us understand watersheds and how we should think about watersheds at a time of extreme weather and flooding.
Okay. I'm going to use the example that you just gave about your bathtub.
My bathtub, okay.
Yeah, because watersheds are defined as areas that drain to a common point. Areas of the landscape that drain to a common point. So basically not unlike a kitchen sink that drains to a common point or your bathtub. So those are the unit of analysis that people like me recommend for having studies related to flood damage reduction, because that's how water flows in the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. Well, we're winding up this half hour. Antonio will be with us in the second half hour. We're going to say goodbye to Katie and Kate and let them continue on with their reporting that they have otherwise today. But let me just finish up by asking the two of you what, in regard to extreme weather, flooding, what do you have your eyes on in the weeks to come, currently and in the days and weeks to come? Kate Payne, can I turn to you?
Yeah, I think there are certainly some questions for farmers in the state who are really struggling at this point. So much of the coverage in eastern Iowa has been focused on the urban areas that mm-hmm. are affected. But you drive the state, you're going to see water pooling across the landscape. Planting for corn and soybean producers is really behind where it should be at this stage in the year. This is the most delayed they've been in decades, and that's putting a real strain on them. So it'll be interesting to see to what extent some of that land, will it stay in production, mm-hmm. these flood-prone areas.
Okay, Katie Pikus, I have 30 seconds before we have to close out this segment.
Yeah, and, so many homes right now are unlivable in southwest Iowa that I'm curious about what our community is going to do, especially if we're set to see more events like this. You know, will they allow people to sell their homes and turn them into green space? That's one of the major questions right now.
Okay, we'll say goodbye to Katie Pikus, our IPR Western Iowa reporter, and Kate Payne, our Eastern Iowa reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Katie and Kate, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And when we come back, Antonio Arenas will be with us of the Iowa Flood Center. We enjoy getting your calls about extreme weather, flooding. Perhaps it's affected you and you'd like to share it. 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Gene Tockley. He's director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. He's been listening to this first half hour of conversation. We'll have him react and give us his view of the extreme weather we've been having and the connection to global climate change. That's when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Records for cold, snow, flooding, and last month hundreds of reports of tornadoes, adding to the list that we're putting on the under the umbrella of extreme weather. We're talking about that this hour. Antonio Arenas is with us, assistant research engineer at the Iowa Flood Center, which is at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. He and his colleagues at the Flood Center have created an online timeline, really hitting home how much extreme weather we've had in the past 12 months. If you'd like to look at it, we're at Iowa Public Radio on Twitter, and we've just tweeted that out within the last hour. Get a look at this timeline, animations, satellite images, videos, maps. It's really, really interesting. Antonio, before we welcome our next guest on to add to this conversation, I wonder if you could read the overview from your timeline, because I think it really sums up what you're doing with this timeline and why.
Sure. So, overview. Between June 2018 and May 2019, extreme weather has taken a heavy toll on Iowa and the Midwest. We have seen significantly above normal rainfall, reservoirs close to uncontrolled releases, flash flooding and tornadoes, an extremely cold and snowy winter, powerful and rare events known as bomb cyclones, rivers spilling out of their banks and flooding communities due to ice dams, levees crumbling or being overtopped, reminding us of our limited ability to control Mother Nature, massive flooding along the Missouri River and its tributaries, and extended periods of major flood conditions as well as flood stage records along the Mississippi River, among others. Each of these weather events is noteworthy, and some of them are even record-setting. However, in my opinion, it is equally, and perhaps more remarkable, that all these events happened within a 12-month window. For at least three decades, scientists have been predicting increasingly frequent extreme weather. The last year provides a frightening glimpse of the devastating and in some cases deadly consequences that extreme weather can have for Iowa and its residents.
An overview written read there by Antonio Arenas of the Iowa Flood Center. Let's welcome Gene Tockley back to our program, Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Agronomy at Iowa State University, also Director of the Climate Science Program there at ISU. Gene Tockley, welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me, Ben.
I understand you've been listening to our first half hour. With your expertise, we're really eager to hear your thoughts on how we should understand the extreme weather events across the U.S. and here in the Midwest.
First of all, that was a fine overview and document that Antonio and his team have put together. And so it's a good launch point for thinking about what's causing all of this. And if we understand what's causing it, then we can have better confidence that we know what to expect moving forward.
Mm-hmm. So what are the most notable weather statistics that you've had your eyes on, and why are they significant?
I'm watching two different types of conditions that set up these floods that we've had this year. I've been watching the second of these for a number of years, but the one that we've had this year that's made this very notable is the early flooding, which is we've had before the heavy rain on snowpack that Antonio has referred to. So, if we think about this in terms of where this water comes from, it's really precipitation that falls outside of our state. So, going back to your bathtub analogy, it's the bathtubs in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Nebraska that empty into our Missouri, and it's the bathtubs in Minnesota and Wisconsin that empty into the Mississippi. So it's no wonder that we're having flooding, and it's not really, this year has been a little bit different than we've had Iowa water contributing to these floods, but primarily it's been outside the state. So that's the first type.
Mm-hmm.
The second type is one that I've been focusing on and watching and developing the physics background to that is the April, May, June flooding that we've had now for the last 30 years that's really been increasing. And this is the one that has really been problematic for our planting, corn planting, and tillage operations in the spring. And so the question is, on both of these, what are the physical causes and what can we expect moving forward in the future? And so we could go into that if this is a time.
Well, tell us, yeah. I mean, some of the causes are captured in this outline, this timeline that Antonio put together. But go into what you see as the chief causes here.
First of all, the first type that I've talked about, since that fall precipitation falls outside of the state, we have to look at what climate change is contributing to changes in our rainfall. And it's very clear that projections of climate change into the future show an increase in precipitation to our north, all the way through Canada and down into the northern tier of states in the U.S. So it's very likely, this is in the winter and spring. We know and models agree that the precipitation is going to increase in those areas. So it's very likely that this kind of flooding that we're experiencing this year is going to be more likely in the future.
Mm-hmm.
The second type is quite different, and it's also related to global climate change. with a warmer planet, we have warmer oceans, and the Gulf of Mexico is a part of those warmer oceans. And so when the Gulf of Mexico warms up, we get this large dome of moisture that develops over the Gulf of Mexico in the early spring, spring and early summer. And so we have this abundant pool of moisture that's larger than it was 30 years ago. Secondly, we have a phenomenon called the low-level jet, Great Plains low-level jet, which brings moisture directly northward out of the Gulf into the Midwest. This is a natural phenomenon, but the difference is now that the Bermuda High to the east and the Rocky Mountain Low to the west have intensified to the point where this Gulf moisture is flowing much more rapidly into our area. So we have more moisture to deal with from the Gulf. We have a stronger jet that brings it into our area in this April, May, June period. And then our thunderstorms are just fueled with this extra moisture. So it's led to a very substantial increase in our precipitation during this period.
And Gene, you probably saw the statistic. I hope I'm remembering this correctly, that the past 12 months have been the wettest in the U.S. in recorded history.
That's correct. And that was, as Antonio has outlined, it started with a very wet autumn, which has been a little bit unusual recently, but that led to a lot of problems with farmers not even being able to harvest their crops in the fall. So this is a new wrinkle. I'm not sure if that's going to continue, but it's certainly worrisome for farmers.
Okay, you went in depth on the causes. Now, what can be done about it?
A lot of this is already baked into the system. The increase in greenhouse gases is clearly leading to this increase in temperature that we're seeing globally, and it's also leading to, it's the physical cause behind these regional processes, as I've mentioned, the warming of the Gulf, the jet that brings this moisture into Iowa, and the pre-existing thunderstorms that we already have. So that part is pretty much already a part, and that's something that we just have to find ways to adapt to.
Okay, let's go to our callers, 1-866-780-9100, if you just joined us. Gene Tockley is with us, director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. Antonio Arenas, he's an assistant research engineer at the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. 1-866-780-9100, asking you for your questions about extreme weather or your experiences having been caught in extreme weather. Let's go to Terry. Terry is in Toledo. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. My question is, being an old person, I remember where the basic theory was to build a wall along all the waterways to control it. And lately, I know the Iowa River was a good example, where they turned around and said, no, let's gain more space to let that water spread out over the land and work its way down at its own rate. How is that program going compared to, the old famous, everybody wants the dam built to protect their home when, in fact, that belongs to Mother Nature?
Interesting, because my limited understanding of it is maybe like you, Terry, there's a trade-off. Gene Tockley, can I go to you? We have this, do you build a wall through the middle of your town if your town is bisected by a river, or do you just expand the green spaces and assume the water's going to flood part of our city?
That's obviously a political trade-off, a societal trade-off that needs to be addressed. Antonio probably is better qualified to talk to the trends in that, but I think a lot of it is still in the discussion stage.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Antonio?
I mean, one comment that I want to make is that rivers need space to expand and contract. So, and that's what we call floodplains. Natural rivers do that, and those spaces are needed. As far as one town making the final decision on building a flood wall or not, that's a decision that every community has to make.
Right. And the floodplains were there a long time before, we started changing the environment and the landscape of our rivers for
and building levees.
And the ecosystems in those along those rivers have long since adapted to periodic flooding.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, great question from Terry in Toledo. Let's go to Shannon. Shannon in Clarion, hi. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Along the lines of what Terry was saying regarding human intervention, my concern is about the farm field tiles that we continue to be putting in the farm fields and the drainage and turning it into surface water rather than groundwater. And also regarding the I just lost my train of thought. Sorry.
Okay, well, you've given go ahead.
Go ahead. Just have an honest conversation about human intervention and what we are doing to cause, removing the marshes, the prairies, the grasses, the trees, those mitigate the water, and we keep removing those and putting more more fields into production.
Right.
And so I just think that the water could be mitigated better with more natural prairies and stuff.
Shannon, excellent points you brought up. Gene, I think this is your area in agronomy, too, those field tiles. We have changed our natural environment so much and our waterways so much, haven't we?
We have put in a lot of drainage tile. It's been estimated that we have about 2 million miles of drainage tile under the state.
That's for those not aware of what drainage tile does, what's a shorthand way to describe it?
It's just putting a trench in the field and putting a 4-inch plastic pipe underneath the soil so it drains water from one spot to some surface waterway that's nearby.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your further comment on how we've changed these waterways and perhaps increased the likelihood of flooding?
Yes, the whole state was really well drained 100 years ago. On a project that's been compared to building the Panama Canal, but now recently we're going back and putting even more in because we're putting it in even on slope surfaces, which are by definition well drained already, but not well enough for the precipitation of the 21st century. So what's happening is that we have more water being moved off to waterways, and it creates more flashiness in the flooding that we're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. You've tied this earlier in our conversation, Gene, in with climate change. And we're always reminded that we can't confuse climate with weather. I wonder, are we getting to the point where we can attribute specific weather events to climate change? What period of extreme weather can we say this is definitely part of it? Or is it still only we can have only assume that connection in large periods of time?
Yes, that's the study of what we call it attribution. What do we attribute these specific events to? I mentioned two different kinds of flooding we have, the first being related to snowfall to our north. We don't have, or at least hasn't been published yet, good enough observations of the trends occur in these types of events to know if this could be related to climate change. The second, it's become very clear that one definitely is related to climate change because of the physical factors that can be linked, as I tried to do, from global temperatures to the Gulf of Mexico to the low-level jet to these heavy rainfall events in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. A question from Paul in Clive. Has anyone studied how conservation programs would keep the water where it lands with the billions of dollars of unfunded conservation programs have minimized this flooding? Antonio, anything to say to that? I mean, we're getting to the political sphere of why it has not happened.
So it's a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but one point that I want to make in reference not to this caller but to the previous one is some statistic that I came across recently. And about 200 years ago, the state of Iowa was 11% of the state of Iowa was considered natural wetlands. And the latest number that I saw is today, less than 1% of the state is still in that state. So kind of just to reinforce the point that we have drained our natural wetlands, mm-hmm. reducing our landscape's resilience to flood events.
Mm-hmm. Gene Tockley, anything to add to Paul's question in Clive about the conservation programs as yet unfunded?
I don't have specific information about that, but I know there's a lot of discussion about better water management. We should consider water as a resource. Most people in the world would really would like to have more water. We have too much. But how can we store it in our natural deep soil reservoirs? Is there any possibility of doing more surface retention of water? It's an active area of discussion, if not research.
Mm-hmm. Our flood future, flood mitigation, is mixed up with our politics, of course. We have a president who has repeatedly called climate change a hoax, a president who, to listen to his rhetoric, is in denial. I think we can agree on that. How does this, I wonder, impact our preparedness and our willingness to tackle these major challenges when the president of the United States calls it a hoax? Thoughts on that? Don't jump in both at the same time. Gene, I'm going to point to you
okay,
first.
Okay, well, yeah, I've thought about that for a number of years. So, yes, the problem is that we are not getting the right messages and incentivized policy at the federal level. States and urban areas are really picking up the vacuum there, filling that with good ideas, and are doing a lot more management in smaller areas. So, but if we had better incentives at the federal level, it would help us to move forward, and it would stimulate, I think, a huge economic growth in areas that are related to building resilience, from mm-hmm. machinery to installation, hardware, infrastructure, of a variety of different ways. But we're just falling behind, and other nations are picking up since we've left a vacuum.
Before we go, I want to invite quickly on Alex Krull is with us, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Alex, welcome to the program in the final couple minutes here. Alex, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, now we're hearing you. We're turning to you in the final couple minutes just to tell us, you know, after we've had the weather that we did in May, we're just into June here. Is this stormy type of weather? It seems that we're getting out of this pattern, but are we out of it? What can we expect in the next few days?
Well, here in the next few days, we are looking at the potential for more rain showers and thunderstorms to develop. Today, we do have a slight risk for severe weather to develop. The greater potential right now looks to be up near Minnesota. Certainly over the next 14 days, it looks like we'll be a little bit less active in terms of having robust severe weather. But overall, we are still looking at an active weather pattern to be moving through Iowa and really across the central plains in the upper Midwest could result in some heavier rainfall and could have a few severe weather events that are embedded within this. So
Severe weather, including tornadic events, tornadoes, severe wind, and so forth?
Correct, yeah. Any severe severe wind, severe hail, and tornadic events, especially as we get into June here. June is typically the peak of when we have severe weather here in Iowa, and really supercell season starts for us in May and goes through most of June. But as we recall also from last year, we had the Pella and the Marshalltown Tornado Day, which occurred on July 19th of 2018. So really throughout the whole summer, you always need to be prepared. But we are looking for a rain, or rather wet June and July as we continue to go through the summer and our convective season.
Wet June and July, anything to say about the temperatures, average, above, below average?
Temperatures right now in some of our three-month outlooks that are provided by the Climate Prediction Center are indicating that we'll probably be just a little bit cooler, but that's due to the amount of rain and thunderstorm activity that we have. Typically, when we have a lot of rain and thunderstorms that move through in a particular summer, because of the amount of cold fronts and other air mass boundaries that move through, we typically end up with a slightly cooler temperature than normal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. From the National Weather Service in Des Moines, Alex Krull.
All right. You're welcome. Thanks for inviting us this afternoon.
Gene Tonkley, this going out here, what is your view? You've been studying this so long. You're the director of the Climate Science Program at ISU. Are those creating public policy, including our elected officials? Are we up to the task here to manage extreme weather connected with climate change? Are you optimistic?
Some states are taking a very active role in this. I was just last night reading the California Climate Assessment Program, and they, of course, have some huge challenges, but they are really stepping up to the plate statewide and some of their cities as well. We haven't been quite as active in our state or in our region. I think we need to be looking at what the science is telling us so that we are better prepared to really deal with this future that's being dealt to us.
Mm-hmm. In the final 30 seconds to Antonio Reynes of the Iowa Flood Center, congratulations, I understand, are in order. The Iowa Flood Center is celebrating an anniversary and has an event next week to celebrate.
That's right. So I want to invite all your listeners to check our website, iowafloodcenter.org. We have an all-day activities planned, and I would like, you know, everyone to come.
Okay. Iowafloodcenter.org.
That's correct.
Is the website to check out as well. We want to thank you both for being with us on this program. Also, the callers, some wonderful input from our listeners this hour. Antonio Reynes is Assistant Research Engineer at the Iowa Flood Center, which is at the University of Iowa College of Engineering. Gene Tockley, Emeritus Distinguished Professor of Agronomy and Director of the Climate Science Program at ISU. Gene, thanks for stepping into our studio. Likewise to you, Antonio.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop and Emily Woodbury. Stephanie Nobria helped us out as well today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, today is Tuesday. That means tomorrow is Politics Wednesday. I hope you'll be on board when we discuss the latest on the political landscape. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.